ocean, even in the underground water, fast becoming a non-renewable resource. And I take a look at the malformed salmon fry, and once in a while I begin to think that maybe Birds Incorporated is trying to develop a glowing duck so it can have 24-hour hunting. But so what I'm trying to say is that I think we have to eventually have to have our own form of self-government, because it's only then that we will be able to make real progress in self-determination, and also trying to replenish or replace, especially the non-renewable resources. There's a great demand on them, and they're fast being depleted, and here we are battling all the time. And that's part of the politics. Keep us in conflict, and that way, domination. We are dominated. And the only time that we'll really be able to make progress is when we are off balance because of the court battles, all the laws that we have to try to change, etc., that are always keeping us off balance. But I think the tribal government would be a good way of beginning this. And between those two, the Western civilization with their dominion, their control, their manipulation of nature, and our way of life, wanting to live in peace and harmony with nature.
Thank you, Oscar. Robert Goldwyn, and then Bishop DeRue, and then Dennis Demert.
Yes, well, I really only want to ask Bishop DeRue a question about his paper, and in fact the same passages that Shelton read aloud. These four are consequences of what you call the techno-industrial view of creation. But in the paper you are very stingy in telling us what that view is, and so I thought it would be helpful to everyone if you would enlarge on it a bit. You say the industrial vision was initially rooted in a Judeo-Christian view of creation, but took on a more rational scientific orientation during the Enlightenment, and then that's all you say about it. Now, if I'm not mistaken, the simplest way to say what the Judeo-Christian view of creation was is that it is a creation of everything out of nothing. But just what this more rational scientific orientation during the Enlightenment was, and why if you would explain that, then it would be clearer why all these consequences flow from that distortion.
The two questions that have just been raised are really closely related one with the other. First of all, Oscar's question about taking dominion in Genesis. I'm not a Bible scholar, and I'll stand correction from others who may have better knowledge available to us. But if there's one thing clear in my understanding of all my Bible studies, I should say two things. One is that the Bible is a living message, not a dead book. It speaks to us today out of the living presence of God and must be interpreted in the light of the living community. Consequently, there's nothing more dangerous than to quote passages out of the Bible in a contemporary context which is not the context in which they were written, or the initial meaning they had. And that word dominion in the Bible does not mean control, manipulation. It means exactly the opposite. It means basically stewardship. There's nothing more common to the whole biblical tradition than the concept of stewardship. And just go back to the Old Testament and read how the prophets, you know, critiqued the king or even the temple if the then leaders of society were not careful to make sure that justice would reign for everyone, that they would look after the orphan, the widow. You have the famous tradition of the Jubilee where all debts had to be remitted and lands restored to those who had lost them through indebtedness or whatever. So that's a very recent distortion of the Bible, done partly out of a polemic, which was an attack by one particular religious sect that disseminated this information. I could give you details on that, but that's not important, as an attack against the church. But it's a total distortion of the Bible. And the constant Christian tradition, not only through the early commentaries on the Old Testament, but right through the fathers of the church, there are volumes being written today showing how the Greek and the Latin wisdom of the church constantly stressed the dimension of stewardship. And that ties in perfectly with our distortion today of the economy. Because the economy, in biblical understanding, comes out of the word stewardship. The economia is precisely the responsibility of the father of the family, of the head of the tribe, to make available all the resources they had for all the members. So there again, when we limit in the English language the economy just to the dollar or the market exchange, we have totally distorted the very notion of economy. Let me put it this way. I was on a plane between Manila and Managua talking with an international economist who helped set up the master plan for the economic recovery of Nicaragua after the revolution. He had brought together some 200 scholars from, you name it, Chicago, London School of Economics, Harvard, everywhere, and they'd come up with this master plan. It was based on the Spanish phrase, la lógica de las mayorías, in other words, the logic of the majorities. That is the attempt at the renewal of the economy. And leaving aside all considerations about how the East-West ideological confrontation has distorted the Nicaraguan reality, I think we also have to give credit where credit is due. The economic plan for the recovery of Nicaragua is based on that principle. In other words, as one economist put it, beans and blue jeans and tortillas before scotch and TV. In other words, the basic necessities of the people must be met. And he said, the economy, because I was telling him that I was a bit overwhelmed by all this technical language when he showed me the 120-page document that was about to be printed. It was going to be the master plan that would be followed by the junta and by all the institutions of the country. And he said, you know, don't let the economists kid you. Economics is really very simple. He says, economics is the science whereby we use our natural resources to feed, house, and clothe our people and give them the physical necessities of life so they can go on from there to the higher things like social life and culture and so forth. And he says, every time an economist tells you that he cannot do that, feed, house, and clothe the people, he's betraying his own responsibility as an economist. He said, don't forget, the decisions that govern our economy are not economic decisions today, they are political. It's political, ideological connotations and principles that are guiding our economy, and that could be applied to what's happening, to the distortion of the economy in America, which is naturally endowed where it could easily feed 10 times the population it's got, but that cash crop for foreign export kind of thing that has been imposed by those nameless people that came up in discussion this morning, like United Fruit and others, is largely why the people are now starving and why the poor, having gone beyond the point of no return, are now rising up in rebellion. But I mustn't go too long on that point and come to the second one, which is closely tied to that, about the rational scientific. Okay, and here we're, I obviously couldn't go into length on that. You'd have had a paper that was 25 pages. We're pointing now to one of the saddest periods in Christian history. At the time of the magnificent discoveries of Descartes, Bacon, Newton, etc., Christianity was at its lowest ebb, and consequently the necessary critique of the new sciences by religion did not take place. And as a result, many of these wonderful scientific ideas gradually became distorted, and we had the appeal to reason for reason's sake, the appeal to science alone, which led to the divorce between religion and science, which has plagued us for about 100 years, the absence of the church from the governing decisions. In other words, the removal of values from progress and science. You know, why do we do certain scientific things? We do them now simply because they can be done. There is no injection there, no critique in the light of values, in the light of the common good, or the will of the people. And that's partly the fault of the church for having been absent. And one of the things that I find gives me greatest cause for rejoicing is that this old divorce between science and religion is over now, and you've only to pick up some of the books by the more advanced scientists of today, I'm thinking particularly of some of the physicists, and you read their language, and they sound like the mystics, John of the Cross, Teresa of Avila, and so forth, because they've come to the limits of their scientific perceptions. We have now discovered that all the basic rules like splitting the atom and so forth no longer hold, and that ultimately there is no such thing as the finest particle. All we've got in the world is relationships, and we're beginning to discover on strict scientific grounds that every level of humanity is interrelated, and that until we get into interdisciplinary approaches, we're going to destroy ourselves. And just to make it very personal, my best understanding of the economy, and one of the reasons why I felt so comfortable with our statement on the economy in Canada, was given to me by a bishop who's a member of our commission, who's a professional biologist. And he began to explain to us how the economy can only at its own peril ignore the basic laws of biology. And that takes in your whole field of ecology, etc. And he applied it, for instance, to the question of acid rain and what was happening to our lakes. And he said that he could fly over low altitude in a plane, and he could tell from the plane which lakes were gone beyond the point of no return. Because, as you know, it's a whole delicate balance of biological chains that clean up their own wastes and repair themselves and hang in a balance. But the moment you bring the level of acidity beyond a certain point, you destroy that initial biological chain, you have a question of no return, and your lakes become quagmires. That should be applied to the whole economy right across the country. We're just foolish if we think we can continue our present intensive type of cultivation, moving, for instance, wheat and beef thousands of miles back and forth at great expense, destroying our agriculture in the process, and for Western Canada, which is my home territory because I was a farmer's son, preparing another Sahara Desert or a Sahel right in the west, at a time when we pride ourselves to be able to go down to Ethiopia and tell the people how to look after the problems of erosion, when we are doing worse things right here at home. And it's just to show that this all ties together. And the biblical concept was one of stewardship. Now, there was no division between the two, but that gradually got lost, partly through the fault of the church, the weakening of Christianity. And we're only coming back to that gradually. And that's why today it's so important that all the native peoples and all the religious groups and all the popular organizations get together in a massive movement to change the mentality and to demand from our politicians that we put in new values into our scientific progress, or it will destroy itself. Sorry for being so long.
Thank you, Bishop DeRue. Dennis Demert, I wanted to call on Dennis Demert next, but I've been asked to call a coffee break, and maybe we could take a 5-minute break, stretch our legs, and then we'll call on Dennis as soon as we take our seats again.
You're well prepared there. You got all the
every time I turn around to
Maybe we should take our seats again. What's the matter? Well, folks, maybe we should take our seats again. Well, should we be seated? Well, maybe we should maybe we should get underway again. We can carry on, I think, until about 4:30. This is a bingo hall, and they do like us to be out by 4:30, and they've been very good about making the hall available to us, and I just remind you of that, because it may mean that when we reach 4:30, I'll have to bring discussion to an end. Well, even if the snowball is rolling, I'm afraid. Well, I'd like to call on Dennis Demert and welcome Dennis, who wasn't able to be here yesterday. Dennis is Director of Native Studies at the University of Alaska, Fairbanks. Dennis.
Thank you. First, I'd like to say, Bishop DeRue, that I don't recall ever hearing a much more forceful or convincing statement of one's beliefs than that which you just gave us a short time ago. Also, I'd like to say that in your statements and in your paper, you discussed some ideas that I was glad to see. One of my concerns in looking at the situations that we're concerned about is that there are a number of ideas expressed by very useful words that are kind of out of vogue simply because from some points of view they're loaded words. Sovereignty, tribalism, subsistence, colonialism, and so forth. And I think you've given some credibility to the concept of colonialism as a word that expresses a condition that is still here. And I think that's a great help. One of the things that I remember about learning about colonization is that when I went to school and took history, we learned about the 13 colonies, and we learned that in 1776, we got rid of the colonial status, and implicitly thereafter we don't have to worry about colonialization anymore because it's gone as of 1776. And then I learned later on, after rejecting the concept for quite some time, that hey, it does indeed cover some ideas that we still need to look at. So I really appreciate the idea that now we can look at it again as a useful concept that we can apply to situations that we have. If we see colonialism as exploitation, utilization of resources, the kind of thing that was going on with the 13 colonies, some people have said that applies to Alaska now as well, the exploitation of resources simply for that sake. And politically, I think one of the most effective ways to colonize an area is to make the colonized people like it, to make them enjoy being colonized, to share a little bit in the resources and the benefits that are derived from colonization. And if we look at the Alaskan scene, I think we have that kind of a situation with oil, some sharing in the resource on the part of the Alaskan citizens. And I think that you would find that there are many Alaskans, many of us who will defend the right to be colonized and not see it in those terms, but in fact, there's quite a trade-off taking place in the state. And I think that colonialization, I think, is a useful concept for looking at situations that we have now. And I think that you've helped a lot to bring that clearly into focus. And one of the things that I wonder about is the Native view in regard to what goes on with us in the colonization process. How much are we being made to buy into something that maybe really isn't in our best interest? How much are we, as you put it, you know, the oppressed become the oppressors? How much are we changing sides, not knowing it, being convinced that we're doing the right thing? And, you know, we kind of like some of the things that we're participating in. How beneficial are they to us overall? This is one of the kinds of things that I think we need to look at. In looking at what is going on, there are a couple of things that really made great changes for Alaska Native people. One of them was the Land Settlement Act of 1971. As of 1971, we relate to each other very differently from the way we did before. One of these ways that has changed is the decision-making process. I can recall that before we had a land settlement in Southeastern, we had the Alaska Native Brotherhood, and I recall that there were ways of making decisions there that worked for a long period of time. One thing that I did not appreciate at the time was the training, the very conscious training process that was taking place with the elders doing the training. What brought this into my consciousness was seeing after 1971 one of the younger men, one of the men of my generation as opposed to the elders, who had been going through the training process and who, in the normal course of things, without the land settlement, would have assumed a leadership role, leadership for lack of a better term, but sharing in the decision making. That didn't happen that way. What happened instead was that the Settlement Act brought about a new way of selecting decision makers. That is the corporate model. The model that we used before is still in place to some extent with the Alaska Native Brotherhood, but without the kind of influence that it once had before. And so the manner of selecting our spokespersons is very different now from what it was, largely because of the settlement. And one of the questions that I have to ask in my own thinking about this is, does this new process bring into play the same kind of leadership skills that we had before? Do the new leaders have, do they learn through the on-the-job training the kinds of things that William Paul, Frank Johnson, Elwood Mark, and many of the others, John or Andrew Hope, and some of the elders, very wise elders, brought into play before. They did a great job. I appreciate that more and more through the years. And I'm not prepared to answer one way or the other because I don't know what on-the-job experience does. I think it does do some of that, but I don't know that it does to the extent that the other does. But we are changing. And as I say, we're trying to make the changes that work, and I think that we tend to like that which we do, because we've got to make it work. And I keep wondering if we're in this colonization process of liking being colonized. I wonder if we're really liking the corporations because they really do the right things for us, or because we've simply bought into the system. And I don't have the answers. It's just a question that I want to pose here now. In the old leadership process, and I really had the privilege of being exposed to the ideas of some of those elders before the settlement, there were ways of making decisions that I didn't really appreciate then. I've grown to appreciate more since then. I was, I guess you might say, one of the young Turks. I was not satisfied with the speed with which the elders were moving on our southeastern settlement. And, well, among other things, I tried to get rid of the old leaders because they didn't seem to be moving quickly enough. In retrospect, I came to appreciate that if indeed we were successful and got in the young men that wanted to be the leaders, we would have had chaos. And those old leaders did two things that I thought were very important. One was they were very sensitive to what people wanted and needed. And they really responded to that, I think. And second, they had a perspective which showed them, I think, times when there was something more important and more necessary than what the people wanted or what people said that they wanted. There were times when they made some decisions when they kind of stood alone, but they had a perspective, I think, learned through their experiences and learned through their education that really came to bear. And I wonder if we have that anymore with the kind of change that has taken place with the drastic change that has taken place in the political structure in the Native community since 1971. I'd like to quickly make reference to something else. We've not only changed our way of doing things, but I think there's something about our character as well that is changing. We're adapting to a different way. In teaching about Native history at the university, an idea that came to my mind was that during the earlier contact period, one thing that happened was that we took the technology that was introduced and adapted it to fit within our cultural contexts. Rifles, other technological items that could promote what we wanted within that context, we adapted to our way. What happened later on, earlier in the century, was aspiration to the other cultural mode of operation. And what we started to do since then was to adapt not the benefits of the other culture, but adapting ourselves to the new culture that we saw. And I think that there's been a great deal of confusion. One thing that we're aware of, one way or the other, I think in our minds now, is that we're losing something of value in our old cultures. I don't know that we have an adequate handle on it, but I wish that we could go on for quite some time on this kind of an issue, because I don't know that we have a handle on some of those really valuable ways of viewing the world that the older Native people had. Another concern that I have is that as we become more educated, the philosopher Ortega made the point that One thing that takes place over time is that we have some aspirations, we have some ideas for change, there are things that we want, and once we get them, once we start obtaining and achieving, those aspirations, as he says, change into appetites. And unconscious assumptions, as he puts it here. And what is happening with us in this change? I don't know that we're standing outside of the situation adequately to see what we're doing. But I'd like to read one phrase or one statement that he puts forth in here about bringing about change with a group of people such as the Native people. You want the ordinary man to be master. Well, do not be surprised if he acts for himself, if he demands all forms of enjoyment, if he firmly asserts his will, if he refuses all kinds of service, if he ceases to be docile to anyone, if he considers his own person and his own leisure, if he is careful as to dress. These are some of the attributes permanently attached to the consciousness of mastership. And that's the kind of thing I think that Native people are moving into. But the one other concern that I have when we do that is that the kind of aspirations that we have in the society that we're working in now is, it reminds me of the chain letters. I remember when I was a little boy that my mother received a chain letter once that said, send a handkerchief to each of the 10 people on the top of this letter and then somehow add your name at the bottom and 4 months from now you'll have 2,500 handkerchiefs. I don't know why, I remember that letter. More recently I've seen something like that said send $100, add your name to the bottom, and to make it even more forceful, gave some instances of people who didn't do that and had bad luck. I think there are some things in the business community that do that kind of thing as well. And with the aspirations that we have in the economic structure that we have now, the one thing that I think about is that the kinds of aspirations that we have for comfort, convenience, security, being millionaires, whatever the society says that we can and should have, place some demands on the environment that we live in. Where does the chain letter end? I think we're starting to see some problems in that as well. There are all kinds of problems that we have here. And one of the things that I think that Native people can do, one of the things that I think can be of value beyond the Native community, is to take a look at how, where does all this go? You know, I think one of the best ways to see how we are is comparing with other ways of seeing things. We're simply not conscious of how we do things until we see other ways, and that's a great value, I think, of a multicultural society. But I'm very fearful that the kind of aspirations that we're developing are for assimilation, whether we intellectually reject it or not. It's kind of an insidious sort of thing that's taking place, and I'm very fearful of Native people simply becoming brown white men. And these are some of the ideas that I'm very concerned about with the Native land settlement, with changes over time, with development in Alaska, and with 1991. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dennis. Orrin Young wanted to speak, and then Henry Hsu, and then Vernita Ziles and Evelyn Hash-Pete wanted to say something as well. So maybe we could proceed in that order for the time being. All right. Orrin Young.
I wanted to say that I think Bishop DeRue has done us a real service in asking us to focus on the phenomenon and the issue of colonialism. Colonialism in all of its various forms. It seems to me, and I think that this has been expressed in a variety of ways by people here today, that in the final analysis, the phenomenon of colonialism is really the heart of the issue. things like protecting the land base in other concrete objectives of that sort are undoubtedly important. Certainly they shouldn't be diminished, but coming to terms with the underlying fundamental realities of a colonial situation seem to me to be really much more fundamental. The bishop talked about the realities of colonialism, and certainly that's an important topic to think about, but I think it's also critical to think very systematically about the roots of colonialism, because only through a clear understanding of the driving forces and the roots of colonial relationships that we can ever really come to grips with it and to deal effectively or to dispose of the unfortunate consequences of colonial patterns. When we begin to think about the roots of colonialism, including what more of us are now calling internal colonialism, which is just as much a reality and in some ways a more difficult reality even than conventional or classical colonialism, one of the first things to recognize is that colonialism is certainly not merely just a policy of particular governments. It is a far more fundamental thing than merely a matter of policy which can be cured by mere policy changes. Colonialism is in fact a very complex relationship between the social, economic, and political imperatives of the dominant society or the dominant group and the psychological as well as the physical responses of the dominated peoples. And for that reason, it simply can't be cured or eliminated, erased through a mere set of formal policy changes or strictly legal changes. And I think we see this very clearly at the present time in the northern context. If we look at one small example of many of the kinds of consequences that long-standing colonial patterns have produced, that is to say, various forms of individual pathological behavior, they're very widespread in northern situations, whether in the form of suicide or in the form of alcoholism or in the form of mental illness or in the form of anomic behavior or in the form of the breakdown of family units. One of the things that's very striking to me in this context is that these individual pathologies don't disappear, are not eliminated just because you eliminate some of the surface policy or legal components of a colonial relationship. So, for example, you institute a home rule government in Greenland, no doubt a great step in the right direction. But on the other hand, you still have a very widespread problem of high levels of individual pathology. You institute various settlements in the Canadian situation, some of which include guarantees of self-determination as well as rights to land bases. You still get very high levels of individual pathologies of all of these various kinds. And the same is true with the different kind of so-called settlement that took place in Alaska in 1971. Clearly, these are responses to deeper realities, to very fundamental problems that are going on and will continue to go on as groups get progressively drawn into the activities of the dominant society, regardless of the strictly policy or legal changes that are made. In order to change the situation, in order to do something about it, it really requires a very profound realization on both sides of the nature of the relationship, and then I think some very deep-seated changes in the underlying sources or roots in the social and economic and political structures of the respective communities. Is that likely to happen? And in particular, is the North different in these terms than some of the other cases that have been discussed today? And here I think that
we really do need to come back from time to time to the challenge that Hugh left us with yesterday afternoon, which was the thought that maybe the North is different, maybe there are characteristics of the North that are signs of or sources of hope. I've, like many of us, I think, sort of troubled by that thought, hopeful about it, but troubled by it at the same time. And I've been thinking about that over the last hours and sort of wondering what the sources of the ambivalence are. I think it cuts in several different ways. On the one hand, the North might be different in a pessimistic way from other places, because I think there's a way in which internal colonialism, at least in the contemporary period, is more dangerous than conventional colonialism. Conventional colonialism is delegitimized. Conventional colonialism is no longer really fundamentally, pervasively, and without reflection an accepted sort of practice. Internal colonialism, however, is a reality, but it's a reality that many people haven't even begun to recognize. So they haven't even begun to sort of think about the problem because they haven't recognized the existence of the phenomenon. And what's more, internal colonialism is a dangerous phenomenon because dominant societies are particularly attracted to controlling the peripheries of their own internal systems because they don't, it seems easier, it's cheaper. It's not so difficult in political and military and security terms to control the northern regions of Canada and the United States and so on as it is to continue to exercise control in the more conventional colonial settings. So it may be that the North is different in that respect in a pessimistic way. But on the other hand, the North is different in other respects too, and they may be more optimistic differences. It may very well be that in the United States, for example, and in the other industrialized countries, that the basic economic structure of these societies is changing, going into a sort of post-industrial computer economy, high technology economy, which would have the interesting characteristic of making the North less important. Not in a sort of ideological way, but in a very sort of hard-headed, practical way. The resources just might conceivably reach the point where the rest of society doesn't need them so much in order to carry on the kind of economy that it begins to develop. In which case, the North might optimistically become a sort of a benign backwater, saved from the consumptive greed, so to say, of dominant societies because of irrelevance. I treat that as a very optimistic analysis. Some of you may not treat it in quite the same way. That's really from the point of view of the dominant society. Are these basic changes going to occur from the top side or the dominant side? One might also ask, is the North different from the point of view of the dominated? And that's no doubt a very complicated subject. But one thing does strike me as significant in this respect. It's just one point that I'd like to mention. And that is that I think that, for example, in the Alaska case, that whatever you may say about the failures of ANCSA, and certainly they've been fundamental. I mean, I've myself certainly been among those who have argued very regularly that ANCSA in some ways is a colossal failure. Nonetheless, I really do believe more and more that ANCSA has had one positive effect. I think it's probably been, both in terms of its operation and in terms of its very failures, probably the most politically consciousness-raising and energizing thing that's happened in the Native communities in modern times, that the very concern stimulated by this development and by its increasingly apparent failures may in fact contribute to a sort of political energizing and consciousness raising on the part of the dominated people in this equation which, while it may not be a sufficient condition to bring about change, I think is probably a necessary condition. And so I think that this development, including things like the Alaska Native Review Commission, we are participating at this very time, in a way are taken collectively among the most hopeful signs of generating the consciousness and energy to break out of this cycle that I think we're seeing anywhere in the world.
Cita.
Can I just add on just a little bit to Orrin's statement, just carried a little bit further. Can we begin...
Opposite, that is simply changing legal forms and institutional arrangements may by itself not affect what happens on the ground an awful lot. Mr. Henry Hsu, yes, sir, sorry.
Especially since we won't have Bishop DeRue with us tomorrow, I'd like to try to draw him out a little more about how he sees the role of the church in dealing with colonial situations. I thought I heard a very sharp and clear message in what you said, and I'd like to really ask you a very simple question, which I'm sure leaves out some of the subtleties, but it's really just a way to invite you to say which subtleties you want to put back in. See, to me, that you argued very strongly that it's the business of the church to show a preference for the poor, to really take the side of the victims, and the rich and the powerful also have souls, I speak as an outsider, by the way, but as I understand it, the church also has a ministry to the oppressors, and so in whatever way it takes the side of the oppressed, it mustn't violate it, whatever its ministry is, the oppressors. But nevertheless, with that sort of constraint, I take it you're really saying the church should be taking the side of the victims of the oppression. And I would think that in Alaska, that would mean taking the side of the natives. And I would like to see if I misheard you and see what qualifications you might want to put on that.
No, you didn't. You didn't misread me, or you heard correctly what I was saying. I would just like to recall that I did say also that poverty must not be limited just to the economic spheres. There's an even deeper poverty at the social and cultural, including religious, dimensions. And ultimately, if you look back to the New Testament, one of the harshest judgments that Jesus repeatedly makes is the judgment on the rich. And he says it will be almost impossible for the rich to enter into the kingdom of God. And the reason for that is that he's really speaking here of spiritual poverty, because the rich already have their reward. In other words, they are not aware that they need salvation. So because they don't desire salvation, they cannot be converted. And God, being a God of love, which means a God of freedom, cannot impose salvation on those who will not accept it. But we must not draw the simplistic conclusion that economic poverty necessarily entails spiritual riches. There are those among the economic poor who are also spiritually extremely poor. The point is that the poor economically are better predisposed to hear the message of conversion and redemption because they have touched their own limitations. They've lost the illusion of thinking that they can play God, whereas the rich and powerful will always unconsciously think they can continue to play God. So that's basically the reason. Now, why should God show a preferential option for the poor? For a very simple reason, as I perceive it, is that God, if God is to be a liberator of the totality of humanity, then it is necessary for God to demonstrate that redemption can precisely reach into the most abject miseries of humanity. And if there's any reason why Christ was born among the marginalized shepherds and revealed himself primarily to those who in public eye were the rejects, the so-called sinners of the day, which were frequently just social rejects, not necessarily moral rejects, it was to show precisely that God's redemption can reach into the depths of human misery. Because if Jesus had saved only the rich and powerful, then obviously the poor would have said, well, salvation is not for us. So there is a bit of a mystery, but it's a reality we have to face. There seems to be a basic law there of the very nature of redemption that God must take a priority option for the poor.
Vernita Ziles,
thank you. My name is Vernita Zillis.
Yeah, sorry, Vernita.
If I can say Berger, you can say Zillis.
Right. Okay.
But thank you.
But you have to remember the names of all these other folks, too.
Right. In my work, I deal daily with threats to the subsistence lifestyle and natural resources, but my work, like that of many natives, also is framed in political reality. And for this reason, I will speak of subsistence and natural resources, but I will do so as an individual, as a native. First of all, I would like to express my gratitude to Bishop DeRue for his articulation of what I can only term as inquit feelings of myself as a native from the native experience. He's brought out some very valid, I don't want to call them theories because they're in practice, but what I'm afraid of and why I asked Berger if I could speak was because I see some very practical examples of what he speaks of happening in Alaska today, and I want people to be aware of them, not just as vague ideas, but as practical examples of what can happen when people make such things as the profit motive their idol. Orrin Young, and what brought this all about was Orrin Young was speaking earlier when we started talking about development, and he mentioned as examples Native people who have been responsible for development, sometimes to the detriment of subsistence, but not always. And the other thing that brought this whole thing to my mind was the categorization of natives and what constitutes a real native. And one of the things that we were talking about at lunch today was my idea that what defines a native or an indigenous person, in my mind, is how important the profit motive is to a person. And if you use that as a basis for definition of natives, then many natives themselves, in fact, do not act as natives because the profit motive is what drives them. I've been reading a novel, which probably many of you are acquainted with, called The Milagro Beanfield War. And within that novel was an expression about indigenous peoples in Arizona and how some of them had been living off the land for many thousands of years, but that their land was being taken away from them by large-scale farming operations. And the way that they justified taking away the land from people who mainly farmed just enough to feed themselves and their immediate family was that they were not profiting off the land. And the idea that natives who do not see a need to develop land except to derive what they need do not deserve land in the Western mind. The profit-oriented economy has been refined to the point that not to profit when profit is possible is to sin against the tenets of this profit-oriented society. And it's very dangerous when this situation exists, and I think that Bishop DeRue articulated it very well. It's dangerous because it provides a powerful justification for the stronger society to take the land. And when you have a Congress that is made up of a majority of believers in the profit motive, you have you're in trouble, because they're in a position to legislate the taking of lands, and they do that from indigenous peoples. The examples that I would like to speak of today are things that I've become aware of. And I know that Judge Berger doesn't like us to point fingers and use names, and so I will describe things that are happening, and I'll try not to use names. Let's say that in the marginalization of Native peoples, you have a sea up north that is very, very rich in oil and other minerals. And let us say that you have oil companies who see that and who recognize it and who want to exploit that. Let us say that that in order for them to be able to extract oil from that sea, they build artificial islands. And let us say that so that they can get to these islands easily, they build causeways from the mainland to those islands. That's already happened. And let's say that one oil company decides that 200 feet of breaching, what we call breaching or culverts, is enough for fish who live in that area to pass through on their way to their spawning grounds, which are located in rivers on the mainland. And let's say that in their experience, it turns out that 200 feet of breaching is not enough, and that the resulting effect on the fish population up there is a 53% decline. Let's say that 15 miles up the coast, then another oil company has another gravel island and wants to build a causeway. And that as a result of the experience in the of the other oil company, I wish I could name names, federal agencies who are asked to comment on the proposal for construction of that causeway recommend 2,000 feet of breaching so that you won't have a resultant decline in the population of those fish. And the permitting agency, even though they've been told by three other agencies that 2,000 feet is recommended, decide that 700 feet is enough. And so that's what the permit says. Let us say that this oil company decides, well, it costs too much for us to maintain 700 feet of breaching. And so they go to the national office of the permitting agency, and they go to the congressional delegation from Alaska, and they say, look, you know how important these oil resources are to your state, and it's costing us too much to do this. We don't want to put 700 feet of breaching. We want 150 feet. And these congressmen and senators send letters of support. And so the oil company is required only to have 150 feet of breaching. This has happened. I read the story in both papers. It was an Associated Press story, and it was a very large one, but unfortunately it appeared during For Rendezvous, and so I don't think very many people paid attention. It was a Sunday, and it was the last day of the great race and whatnot. But since then, this has been about a month ago, I've been waiting vainly for any follow-up from those papers on this story, because it was a very well-written story, and I wanted to know what was happening, whether or not someone was challenging that oil company and saying, if 200 feet results in a 53% decline of the fish population, then what will happen if you only maintain 150 feet? I finally got frustrated and called the called the regulating agency, pardon me, and asked them what's going on, and they said, well, actually, all along, the kind of footage that we were discussing was that which would be required permanently, not during construction. And so they will be required to maintain 150 feet, but only during construction. Permanently, they will be required to maintain 700 feet. I said, well, how long will construction take? Said, between 1 and 2 years. I went back to the record of decision that I got in the mail, and lo and behold, that record of decision for the permit that was granted on the basis of 700 feet mentions two breaching lengths, one of 500 feet and one of 200 feet, for a total of 700 feet. And in the same paragraph says, these breaches shall be maintained during Gravel Island and Causeway construction. And so I was lied to, and I didn't like it. But to me, it says one thing also, that we have a state government which is capable, that has the authority to prevent something like this from happening. And through the circuitous narration, I come back to what Bishop DeRue says, that if the profit motive becomes your guiding force and your idol, then you, like the state of Alaska, can be placed in a position of deciding whether or not you can afford to protect the environment. And you, like those oil companies, can decide the same thing. Recently, I was in Fairbanks and testifying at a hearing on some new permits that will be required of the placer mining industry, because the placer mining industry has been operating in Alaska for the past 100 years, and we've seen a steady deterioration in the quality of Alaska's rivers and streams as a result of their operations. And the EPA now proposes a very strict permit, and I went up there to speak in favor of it. And what happened was, you had miners who were saying basically the same thing as the oil companies, that the new permit will require technology that will cost money, and that they basically cannot afford to protect the environment and mine at the same time. My answer to them was that if you cannot afford the technology to operate a clean placer mine, then you are in the wrong business. If it's too expensive for you, then get out of the business, because what you are doing to the waters and the fisheries is too expensive for those who subsist. And there are still a great many people in rural Alaska who subsist on fisheries and other natural resources affected by those mines. I promised Tom that I would keep this short.
Well, you've got everybody's attention.
So I will keep it short. I just have a couple of questions for Bishop DeRue, and I know he's leaving, and I know that these may very well be what I would consider rhetorical questions, but there were two concepts that he brought up in his paper that maybe he can answer in his next paper. Number one was the quotation that faith without works is dead, and I have a question, which is, what is works without faith? I feel like I am of a generation that constantly has to ask that question, because we strive to do good things, but we don't see the need for the faith in order for us to do that. Those good things. The second thing is, he mentioned that the difference between the call to death and the call to life, and Christianity is a call to life. And he says the call to death requires sacrifice. And I guess in line with that first question is, I just wonder why the call to life was based on the death of Christ, and why was Christ sacrificed? I should close on that. I just want to say that the Review Commission, the Alaska Native Review Commission, in its year-long presence in my life, has forced me to grow in awareness. And for that, I am eternally grateful to Judge Berger and to the members. And thank you.
Thank you, Vernita. Thank you very much. Vernita is director of Rural Alaska, it's called RARA, Rural Alaska Resources Association. And as quite obviously, she knows whereof she speaks. Well, Bishop DeRue, I don't know whether I have the courage to ask you to respond, but if you wish to do so, please.
Not only am I happy to respond, I can do so very briefly. First of all, I totally agree that works without faith is no better. So the two balance one another. The point was that those statements in New Testament were in a polemic situation where people thought that you could have faith without works. The two are interdependent, one on the other. So I think you've answered your own question. The second question is a very profound one. Why was the call to life based on the death of Christ? We must remember that God did not want the death of Christ. Must get out of that old idea that he had to be sacrificed because that would appease an angry God. That's Old Testament, not New Testament. Simply because Christ spoke the truth and did the works of justice, and as a result, the powers of this world did him in. But that's precisely in his apparent defeat that God's power was shown, and the power of love is that because he died out of love, he rose from the dead. And that's the central mystery of Christianity.
Well, thank you, Bishop DeRue. And I think we're all grateful for that you did respond to that question. It's 4:30, and Evelyn Hashpeet asked me if she could say a few words, so I'll let Evelyn have the floor. And tomorrow at 9, when we reconvene, we really do have to leave at 4:30 so these folks can get the table set for bingo. Bernie Nietzschman and I almost said Sheldon Jackson. It's just because I'm getting Sheldon Kachetag top of the list. Evelyn Hashpeet, go ahead.
Okay. In Inupiaq, the Bible, an accounting of the Middle East history is what, as interpreted into the Inupiaq language, means recent history. And that era, about 6,700 years ago, is what we call recent history. I wanted to say something because Oren said, and the North has to be kept not because of irrelevance, but because of complete relevance to the retention of the world as we know it. The development that can go on, can only go on with the consent of our people, of our leaders. And our leaders, I'm going to read a little bit on my statement, our leaders, okay, I'll read this, our men. And our men have thought of solutions to keep the colonist society alive. They say to move the homes to the mountains and keep the lowlands for growing food for their people. Our leaders are capable of leading everyone. These men are known because they have charisma. Charisma, for an English word, developed by repeated teaching of the elders. Charisma because they were always a little more alert, a little quicker than their peers, given wisdom by we all raised them. listening to all reports of our daily lives, fairness to lead us, loving care to keep us. We have a well-defined code of ethics among us, and we always have a consensus of all of us when we go to defend our land and our lives. I've been told from the elders, by the elders, to speak from my heart, because I have a gift to my people. My gift is from God, because I am an Inupiaq and Atna and white. The way for us to coexist is to allow the village tribal governments forever to continue status quo, valid existing rights, and these terminologies that Ituk, Charlie Edwardson Jr., has coined throughout his history as an Inupiaq, in true defense of his Inupiaq ancestral birthright, as his life has shown us. We have the leaders in place. We have the ideas in place, and they are for conservation of the earth now. The worst thing is if we follow other ways: development of minerals, oil, gas, atomic power, damming of water, flooding, coal, monuments, engraving of images. The things which the original people have the birthright responsibility to protect, the air, water, earth, animals, and people, will themselves purify our environment. We have seen civilizations come and go. The things we are protecting protect us. We must be left alone in our culture, language, and lives. And Anxa is the people that were past Anxa were threatened with annihilation of the rest of us native people. But the fact is, Anxa is the instrument to annihilate us. No one has the right, the God-given birthright to Alaska but us, the original inhabitants of Alaska. The village people, the tribal governments, the keepers of the land, air, water, animals, and people. We are giving you in our true spirit of sharing the tools to keep the world as we know it alive for generations yet to come. To enjoy by practice of our religion, songs, dances, hunting, fishing, and trapping rituals, language, culture, and preservation of the only way to live. Not through blood sacrifices, wars, killing, starvation, human rights violation, but peaceful concern for one another. Love and dignity as our birthright responsibility to keep the North as a haven for the animals, air, water, earth, and real people.
Thank you. Well, tomorrow we will convene at 9 o'clock, and at noon we've been invited to go down to the North Slope Borough's Anchorage office and look at their geoprocessor, I think it's called, which displays the whole of the Arctic slope right across North America. Quite an interesting thing to see, and you're all, I believe, invited. I don't know. So we'll see you at 9 a.m., and thanks very much.
The letter that's being released tomorrow at 2 p.m. in Quebec, 10 a.m. our time.
Oh, I see.
Is that relevant?
Yeah. Hold on, I must read it. Oh. Well, we're through, yeah, for today. I just was wondering about tomorrow, whether after this peters out, we shouldn't consider moving on to something else. And the idea I had